Thank you, Dennis, and congratulations, and John, congratulations on this inaugural event. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you, I think, for asking me to speak about the economic aspects. At least you demoted me to second most dismal, which is excellent. I suppose I'm going to begin at the euro area and work outwards, because I think the crisis going on now isn't at all just a euro area crisis for some of the reasons that Anne referred to. If you asked me as just a summary view of the euro area crisis, I would put it in 6 words. Probably no cataclysm, probably no growth, or at least not much growth outside Germany and a kind of Central European bloc for some time. In other words, no cataclysm. I don't think that the euro area is about to fall over a cliff. I have exactly the same kind of comparison in mind that Anne had. But there are many ways of going over the brink that don't involve being on a cliff. Let me start with why do I not think it's going over a cliff, then come to the question, what kind of brink do I think it's on? It's a little bit this smooth downward slope Anne was talking about, or bumpy downward slope. And finally, say how could we try to do better at the EU as well as euro area level. Now, I do think that in February, there was a clearer message about the political force driving the euro area. I think that the decision to make another loan to Greece tells one not masses about the economic future of Greece, but it tells you a great deal about the future of Germany. I think that in February, Germany, after really agonizing, I think many people, many insiders thought it was 50-50 or less that the Greece would again be supported. There was clearly a decision in Berlin which had the crucial vote that the kind of national strategy for Germany was best pursued within the EU and within the euro area. There'd been a soul searching back in November 2010. The Chancellor's Office commissioned some studies, I think it's fairly well known, to look at options for Germany, at least to explore them a bit. And in February, clearly this was reaffirmed at a high political level. We are gambling, in a sense, on staying in Europe. Let's just try to get the incentives right, the rules right, which matter a lot for Germany, and let us try to limit the transfers from the German population to pay for this one. Now, if at a high political level, I do think that was reaffirmed in February. I think that arose that awoke all sorts of economic questions, because if you think back over the previous 40 years, if you think of the period, say, since 1972, roughly onwards, there's been this tension periodically between the leadership, the political leadership in Germany, and the monetary leadership in the Bundesbank, which has been the kind of guardian of a low inflation, very stable economic model. And I think it's fair to say that now in these recent months, since the political leadership put an even stronger vote into the unification process in Europe, the leadership of the Bundesbank has, as in the past, worried where in monetary and economic terms that geopolitical or Euro-political strategy is going to take them. I do think that in the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to have a continuing tension in Germany about the implications of making the euro area work. Because any of the successful ways forward for the euro area involve, in the short run, quite a large exposure of the central banks in the north to the periphery. Through the what's called Target 2, through the clearing system in Europe, the central banks in Northern Europe building up very large claims indeed, financing the balance of payments deficits of the south because capital markets aren't working. So a huge exposure, a risk exposure is building up. Secondly, any solution in the euro area is going to involve what was really agreed to be the exit strategy from the global crisis for all countries back 3 years ago, which is you have a very expansive monetary policy, and that facilitates having a more restrictive fiscal policy and bringing bank regulation back on track. But you have to have an easy monetary policy to carry the thing along. And you have to remember that Germany now really is working at quite a high pace economically and is probably on the beginning of a long 6-7 year boom, because interest rates are going to be very low for Germany within the euro area. So there will be this ongoing tension, and it's a rerun of the monetary diplomacy tensions of 40 years. Issues of competitiveness, issues of inflation, disagreements about these didn't go away with the monetary union. And these tensions are understandable. Berlin will see rules, and it's insisted on fiscal rules, and that's very important. But in a way, it's not absolutely clear that the Bundesbank has come yet to live with the change in rules that imply being just part of a monetary area. I think that is important, and there'll be a process of hammering out compromises. Now, supposing that's right, that the euro area doesn't go over a cliff, that's a rather limited definition of success. I think it's quite possible that Europe could go over a brink. There's a significant risk that Europe could go over a brink in a more gradual and insidious way. And that's that the growth process breaks down. And not just growth, but a confidence that the European mechanism can generate growth. This doesn't just affect the periphery of the euro area. If you go and travel in the Baltics, if you go and travel, as I do more often, in the Balkans and southeastern Europe, in the other euroized economies, you find that there's been a complete crisis, not just a breakdown of growth, but especially in the former transition economies, an unease that the European model isn't going to deliver that political and economic convergence, which was the heart of the matter. And as Anne said, there isn't a very easy substitute identity for that. In a sense, this strategy crisis is making clear that Europe doesn't have a proper identity and needs to invent one. I think the growth dilemma also brings with it the risks of a two-speed Europe. But I would say several two-speed Europes. The most obvious one and the most worrying one is that the euro area probably is going to integrate much more tightly. You can't be sure. It's possible it might fall apart. But if it doesn't, and I would guess it doesn't, then it integrates much more tightly. And as Anne and Graham said, other countries like the UK, Sweden, imagine, for example, in this circumstance, Turkey could easily be a member, would be an outer ring that are not really very integrated. Now, in a way, if you're a Eurosceptic, that sounds pretty good, actually. But of course, you are subject to the laws. It's also the case that then you don't have a defense identity. You don't have a foreign policy identity. Without countries like the UK in it, you don't have those elements of quasi-federal identity, which probably are essentially part of the European project. So, two-speed because the euro area integrates faster than the rest. Two-speed also in a worrying way, which is the periphery of the euro area, the Portugals, Greece, Spain, grow much more slowly. Southern Italy grows much more slowly. And I worry like Anne, that slow growth does bring out nationalism. But what I do know from having worked at various times when I was at the IMF, leading missions to Hungary and to Belgium, is when you have countries that have very severe debt crises and are growing slowly, it also causes internal political problems, north-south problems, left-right problems. Think of the tension Spain is experiencing today between northern Spain, which broadly is a very rich and growing integrated area, and southern Spain, which is not. Think of the left-right tensions in some countries, such as Greece. I think you also could get a two-speed Europe in another sense, and it was brought home to me by something Graham said. There's a risk that the really important integration decisions become intergovernmental, and therefore they're negotiated among governments, and that the Commission is cut out. Well, again, if you're a Eurosceptic, this sounds like nirvana. But in fact, for all of the smaller countries, the Commission is a guarantor, in a way, of the EU system. It's not just part of the rules, it's part of the way you create rules. So in all of those ways, slow growth, a two-speed Europe of different kinds, could be very threatening. Now, last set of comments. Surely one can do better than this. I see that in two departments. I mean, there are some economic ways one could do better, and I'll talk about those. But I think there are political institutional ways too. And while I spent the first part of my career really with a very slightly Marxist belief that the economic infrastructure drives the politics, over time I've come to think probably no, the politics is very important in determining how the economics flows, and I think in Europe that is the case. Let me begin with what could be done better economically. Some of that is fairly sort of technical and boring, and it's things like wages. Countries like the Netherlands have been through a very big cycle. Since the Netherlands did a hard peg with Germany back in 1983, it's been through two huge boom and bust cycles, really quite astonishing, and it got through it perfectly well. simply because wages were very flexible, asset prices were quite flexible, the budget was put in order. There was a social consensus that we have to do this. It started in 1983 with an agreement, the Wassenaar Agreement between the government, the unions and industry, and that basic consensus is held. You could say that Ireland, forgive me because I was a director of the Central Bank of Ireland until December, but I think Ireland demonstrates some of those qualities. It probably has some of the flexibility that you need to get knocked around in a monetary union and say, okay, we have to live with this. So wages and other social elements have to be more flexible and adjust. And it's only in this last agreement with Greece, only in the agreement signed in March, that this issue of wage flexibility really came center stage. Before that, there were, I think it was about 28 pages of structural conditionality, and wages scarcely featured. So understandably, it's a very sensitive political subject. Secondly, probably the budgetary policy that's being pursued in the euro area is just too uniform. People are, I think you have to have a tough budgetary policy, but it's one size fits all. I think as these economies are slowing down, you have in some cases to be more flexible with the fiscal targets on a case-by-case basis. A place like Greece, not much room for maneuver. Other places, yes, provided you're on the right course, you don't have to do it this fast in all cases, and that's what the IMF in its report this week is saying. The surplus countries, Germany particularly, could do more, not necessarily by expanding their budgets more, but certainly by opening up their service sectors more and becoming more receptive to exports from other parts of the European Union. There's a lot of liberalization still could be done in the German services sector. You probably need, even if you don't admit it, to have some contingency plans on the economic front for a centrally financed infrastructure program of building up European networks. That works really slowly, but the announcement effect of that kind of thing work really quite fast. So you need more contingency plans in case growth really fails at euro area level. And then very importantly, there's an area of law and of rules which has gone disastrously wrong. We have in the euro area and in the European Union a single banking market and a single banking license. But you don't have deposit insurance, bank resolution, bank bailouts at the level of the euro area, still less the European Union. And that means in a country like Ireland, when the banks start to go wrong, it hits the public debt. The public debt goes wrong, it hits the banks. You get vicious circles. This is what's happened in Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and Spain. And in fact, Ireland and Spain had very little public debt at the start of this. Each of them, I think, had less than 35% of GDP of public debt. What happened was when the banks went wrong, it all went onto the local public debt, and you got this dreadful feedback. So you need to move bank resolution to the center. And I think European civil servants have known that for a long time. They've proposed it. But there's no political agreement to bail out other people's banks. And this, a bit like the concern about inflation in Germany, these are areas where the national instinct is very, very strong. And probably that's got to change to some extent in a monetary union. Maybe you also need these things called Eurobonds, joint bonds. I am a bit cautious on this, but I can see as part of the architecture in the long run, maybe some jointly issued bonds could be an incentive, an anchor, and a risk-free asset for the union. But the other part of what needs to be better, I think, is the politics. And there the justice, to my mind, a perception gap. I mean, take Spain and Germany as illustrating this. After the recent European summit that agreed on all the basic rules that Germany was pressing for on the fiscal front, the Spanish Prime Minister came out and said, but you have to understand we're making a unilateral declaration of our budget deficit because fiscal policy is a sovereign concern. Now, that choice of words was amazing. What led him to choose those words, I don't know. There are many things that could have played well in the press at home, but what he was really saying was it went straight to the heart of everything that Germany was trying to secure, which was that fiscal policy can't possibly be a sovereign concern in a monetary union. Meanwhile, when you go to Germany, you find there are many people in Germany who say, but there's got to be some sort of ceiling on inflation. We can't have inflation above 3% in Germany. It's just unimaginable. Well, the truth is that's undesirable to have higher inflation than that in Germany. But in a monetary union, you're going to have higher inflation in some countries if there's room for the others to recover their competitiveness. So you can't just think nationally in terms of inflation. Here in Germany and Spain are elements of psychology where one sees that the political underpinnings, the sense of being part of one monetary union, is not working. And that is something that will have to gradually change. In a sense, behavior has got to become in line with rules, and the area of banking, the rules have got to become consistent. I am not completely pessimistic on that. I think, firstly, the leadership in Northern Europe generally has concluded they want this thing to work and to stay in it. There isn't a choice in terms of geopolitics. I also think there is change coming, probably. It's very possible that in France there'll be a substantial change politically. Germany has elections in under 18 months' time. It's very possible that will bring changes in the political constellation in Germany. When we come back to look at the way the rhetoric in terms of politics and solidarity, I would guess that within 2 years this would have changed a very great deal. And to some extent the policies too will be working more effectively. That's why I think there are opportunities there. That's why I think that it is valuable for occasions like this to bring people of different disciplines together, and in the United Kingdom, because I think, like Graham, that the United Kingdom has a lot to bring to the table and a great deal to lose by not being at the table. Thank you very much.